Well, welcome to the Best of Acro podcast, session number one. We have the opportunity to have interviews from our top scoring abstracts in the 2022 meeting. I get to work with Dr. Asona Louie, a PGY5 from UC San Diego, and Claire Lanier, PGY4 from Wake Forest. Really excited to kind of review your work. We're going to get started by chatting with Claire, as we have decided to use first names for the duration of this podcast. And Claire, just give me a little bit of background on yourself and kind of how did you get connected with your project?
Yeah, so I went to medical school at Wake Forest and knew before I got into medical school that I wanted to go into radiation. So I've worked with a number of folks in the department for years, I guess going on 7-8 years now. And one of the attending that I did this project with used to be a resident when I initially started, and we worked on projects together, and he's been a really great mentor. I think he's, you know, a rising star in head and neck research and lymphoma. Those are his areas of expertise. And so he worked hard to get this data to do this secondary analysis of a randomized controlled trial. And I really appreciated him allowing me to participate in this.
Great. Why don't you tell us the kind of title of your study and then kind of a summary of that initial abstract that was presented earlier this year at ACRO?
Right. So as it stands right now, our project is titled Examining the Impact of Tumor Bulk on Outcomes for Patients with Bulky Diffuse Large B-Cell Lymphoma, a Secondary Analysis of an Alliance CALGB-A50303 Trial. And when I presented it at ACRO, we referred to it as examining the theoretical role for radiation in these patients. So what we did was we obtained this data from the clinical trial and specifically upfront PET imaging for all of these patients prior to starting treatment. And just for some background, these patients were treated just with chemotherapy and they were assessing the efficacy of R-CHOP versus a more intensified chemo regimen of DA-EPOC-R. And so we obtained their pre-treatment PET scans and then, of course, the outcomes data that trial found. And we decided, as radiation oncologists, right, that we were going to see what could we look at on these scans to tell us, you know, based on the outcomes data, could these patients have benefited from radiation? Which, for folks, I'm sure you all know this, and folks in the lymphoma realm, is kind of a big question. So, you know, maybe pre-R-CHOP radiation used to play a bigger role, and now that's a little less clear. And we have a few studies showing, yes, it's helpful, a few studies saying no, but of course some of these studies were in more low-risk patients, so could it be high-risk patients that need radiation up front and not just for residual disease? So what we did was we had two independent reviewers look at the PET scans, these patients' upfront initial PET scans, and actually measure all of their sites of disease and identify the largest lesion and measure it. And we measured it in three dimensions. And we picked the largest measurement, and we confirmed with one another that we were identifying the same lesion. And then we averaged our two measurements to come up with that patient's whether or not they had bulk. So we measured and then assessed for, okay, based on did they or did they not have bulky disease, and then looking at their outcomes, did patients with what we measured as bulky disease have worse outcomes, and could they have theoretically benefited from radiation?
No, I think that's kind of a very novel way to take data and say, you know, who are the people that need something escalated for? So based on kind of what you did here, what were kind of some next steps that happened after this initial finding?
Yeah, so what we initially found was that upfront in all of the patients, and there were only 150 some PET scans available for all the trial patients. So we had a smaller cohort than initially in that study. But when we look at all comers in our cohort, there was no difference in outcomes. Statistically significant difference in outcomes in patients with what we measured as bulk, and we looked at bulk as 5 centimeters, 7.5 centimeters, and 10. And so that's what I had initially presented at ACRO. But since that time, we've worked with a PhD statistician, dug a little bit more into the data, and we did some. We looked into their treatment, whether they got R-CHOP or the more intensive chemo, and outcomes also stratified by bulk. We looked at their IPI risk group stratified by bulk, looked at outcomes, and then we looked at a three-way interaction of their chemo regimen, their IPI risk group, and bulk. And again, no statistically significant finding. But we do have, you can see, we made a forest plot that's pretty easy to kind of see the trends. But certainly there are trends towards worse outcomes, particularly in the patients in IPI risk groups 3 to 5, and then in patients receiving R-CHOP with bulky disease. And so what that suggests, perhaps, again, all of this is not statistically significant, but does suggest that perhaps there is a certain high-risk group, particularly with the standard of care R-CHOP, which is still what most people receive, that could benefit perhaps from consolidative radiation. And since we've been preparing our manuscript, I've dug in a little more to the prior trial. And I think one of the limitations is that these trials are designed such that there's a waiting period before people can, you know, as they get enrolled, before they can get started. And certain high-risk patients with rapidly progressive disease are not being enrolled. And in fact, in the overall cohort of patients in that initial study, and in our cohort of patients, the minority were patients with that high IPI risk group. So in fact, I do think, you know, future studies, if we could allow for more flexibility, perhaps, so we're catching the full spectrum of disease, or perhaps looking specifically at just folks with high risk disease, I think we might find more indications for radiation there.
No, I think you highlight one of the challenges for those of us that enroll patients. It does seem to slow the process down some as you're checking, you know, kind of making sure you check the boxes. And as somebody who sees a diversity of patients, some of the after trial reviews that get you a little closer to the real world, you know, what patients you're actually seeing can be very, very helpful. For those of us that don't treat a lot of lymphoma, why don't you remind us what the IPI score is?
Right. So it is a score, and you have five questions you ask to develop your answer. So the first is age. So less than or equal to 60 years would be 0 points. Greater than 60 would be 1 point. The Ann Arbor stage. So if they're a stage 3 to 4, that would be a point. Or if they're less, it would be 0 points. ECOG performance score is another factor, with an ECOG of greater than or equal to 2 being 1 point. And those with ECOG of 0 or 1 having no points. A serum LDH greater than 1 times normal would be a point. And a normal LDH would be 0 points. If they had greater than 1 extranodal site of disease, that would also be another point. And so those add up to 5. And so the data we found was that, you know, the worst outcomes are in the folks with IPI risk groups 3 to 5. For instance, and in fact, the original study did find a correlation with IPI risk group and outcomes, even though ours was just a trend.
And now that you've been in the clinic as well, seeing some of these patients, are there things that this particular study has influenced in the kind of clinical management there at Wake Forest of your lymphoma patients?
No, I think just reflecting back to my first rotation with Dr. Hughes, who's our lymphoma expert, and, you know, preparing to see a patient with lymphoma and, you know, thinking I'm going to find a slam dunk answer. I mean, there isn't one. Right. So I think that it would be nice to have more clear guidelines on which patients would really benefit from this, because, you know, we can help people with this very severe, potentially severe disease. And while we want to avoid radiating those who don't need it, if we could, you know, add that on and have them not recur, you know, that would be great, obviously.
And in terms of, you know, kind of chatting with medical oncology and having multidisciplinary care for our lymphoma patients, do you feel like anything in this study or kind of just in the literature in itself kind of helps you to advocate for more med-onc referrals, just to have the discussion with rad-onc, particularly in these diffuse large B-cell patients?
Yeah, I think that luckily we do have a multidisciplinary tumor board that Dr. Hughes is on and we participate in. And so we can discuss. It's always nice, right, to have a few more referrals and just have the conversation, even if it's you don't need radiation. But I do think it's important. And, you know, I think what I've found kind of with the literature search, writing this manuscript up, is that in the original trial, patients in those higher IPI risk groups did do better, statistically significantly better, with the more intensive chemo. So the question of, do some people need extra treatment? Probably. Is it chemo? Is it radiation? Jury's still out.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of with the formalization of the Unfolder study, mm-hmm. there's at least kind of some continued robustness at least in the R-CHOP population of having those bulky patients at least have the referral and the discussion. And as our techniques get improved, I think that's the argument in the Hodgkin's realm too, but, you know, as our techniques get improved, that medium dose radiation that we might be giving, maybe it's a low enough risk that even if we're overtreating a few people, it kind of is the pendulum swinging back from everybody right. gets radiation, nobody gets radiation. I think it feels like we're in this swing back to maybe putting radiation back into some of the lymphoma paradigms. And that, of course, is a little bit more editorial, but I think that your study It's good for radiation oncologists to be involved in lymphoma research. So really credit you and your mentors for pursuing what was a lot of work to go through and measure all those things and then try to do the deep dive. Any final thoughts that you would like to convey about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma or your research experience?
I think that a big area of study now, of course, is genomics or, tumor genetics, molecular profiles. And so, can that data also add to what information we use to decide how high risk someone is? Surely, right? So I think that'll be a big player too. Could there be anything that tells us someone's going to respond better to radiation or just need more? So I think that'll be key in future studies.
Final question. Anything for future budding researchers that you wish you had done differently in designing this project or participating in this project? Or you're like, next time I'm going to totally do X.
Gosh, I mean, hard to say. I do think, as again, I've been reading more, and the definition of bulk has just changed over what 50 years almost. So initially was defined on chest X-ray. So as I was reading, I thought, gosh, should we have measured, metabolic tumor volume, or there are these new definitions of bulk, which, are those more relevant than just the largest diameter of the lesion, perhaps? But, in this day and age, I think we can still add to the literature with what we've done, and we still have access to the data, so maybe that can be our next project.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And I'm so glad you could join us on this kind of Best of Acro podcast. So thank you. And Asona, I am going to move on to you next. So similar question to get us started. Tell us a little bit about yourself and then a little bit about how you connected with your project.
Sure. Wonderful. Thank you for having me again. I'm Asona Louie, and I'm a PGY5 at UC San Diego. I am actually, I'm an MD-PhD from Kansas, and so I went through my training there initially at the University of Kansas, and I'm really a cancer cell biologist and T-cell biologist by background and by training. But when I came into residency, I was very intrigued about the possibility of learning to leverage all of the imaging that we get on our cancer patients into data. I wanted to know more about how can we use all this imaging for research purposes and to, answer unknown questions right now. And so that, I knew for my Holman time that I was going to be going into the wet lab, but I wanted to, get my feet wet a little bit with, some clinical research. And, that's how I kind of connected to the lab of Tyler Siebert. I also wanted to understand more about MRI and how it works and, and all of that. And so that's really what his background is in. And so, I asked him, what projects might be available in the lab. And he really, piqued my interest with this one, since the FLAME trial had just been published right around the time that I was asking about it. And we had this kind of crazy idea that, maybe we could start applying some of what we've been looking at with restriction spectrum imaging to contouring in that FLAME, based on that FLAME result.
Yeah, very interesting data always in the prostate world, and we keep getting new imaging modalities, and then we have to rethink all of our clinical practices, combination of MRI, many years ago now, and then now the PSMA PET spectrum as well. So why don't you tell us the title of your abstract that was presented earlier at ACRO, and then kind of give us a little bit of a summary of those results.
Sure. So the title from that abstract was Reignite RT Boost, an interim analysis of a prospective international study of radiation oncologists accuracy in contouring prostate tumors for focal radiotherapy boost on conventional MRI alone or with restriction spectrum imaging assistance or RSI. And basically for this study, you know, we were really looking at, there's been a lot of interest in adding a simultaneous in-field boost or SIB to the dominant prostatic lesion for a while. But, just recently with the FLAME trial at the time that I was coming into my PGY 2 year, had just been published, was really our first randomized trial with, level one evidence that there was, biochemical, control or, an actual clinical benefit long-term to boosting that intraprostatic tumor. You know, traditionally we treat the entire prostate gland to a kind of a uniform dose, and we know that gray just based on, side effects, GU and GI toxicity. And so the thought has been that by adding this SIB that we can get, better disease control and ideally without a lot of additional toxicity. And I think really that was what was most exciting about the FLAME results, was that this biochemical benefit was not at the cost of additional, GI and GU toxicity. We don't get a lot of free lunches usually when we, are ramping up dose like this. And so really, I think, that is because that exciting result was really because of being able to accurately target that tumor, And so, the contouring that was done in the FLAME trial and really in all of the kind of DIL boost trials that you see coming out, is done in direct, conjunction with an expert GU radiologist. And, I unfortunately, radiation oncology departments don't tend to employ a full-time radiologist to help with every, contouring case for, our prostate volumes. And so, this was supposed to be, supposed to be contouring the visible tumor on multiparametric MRI, and that's just not really part of RADONC training. And we had a feeling that from speaking to some of our colleagues here and some of our colleagues that come from the GU meetings, that people were a little uncomfortable, with how their confidence in, really identifying those tumors. And so, our lab has had, kind of a long history of really adapting the restriction spectrum imaging, framework from that was originally really used more in CNS MRI to the prostate tissue. And what this really does is takes in, really biological information about the prostate gland and water fluid, fluid movement. And so we were taking that really restricted fluid movement compartment, and that when you apply that to the diffusion weighted imaging, you end up with these heat maps that look a lot like a PET scan, where you've got, ideally that tumor in the prostate glowing red, which we saw would really probably make it easier and more comfortable, for radiation oncologists to find that DIL quickly and, confidently, with that efficiency you need with your contouring in the clinic. So what we were able to do then was have about 44 radiation oncologists from institutions all over the world contour DILs on 40 patient cases. I think at ACRO, it was we'd only presented the data on 20 cases, but we've now increased it to 40, and we're able to really show that adding that RSI map overlaid onto that T2 imaging really improved the accuracy and the comfort of those radiation oncologists with identifying that tumor.
No, I think, just your description of, kind of this overlay and the ease and the improvement in contouring for other disease sites in the setting of PET, non-small cell lung cancer, in particular, of how nice it is when it just like jumps off the page at you. And I think it's very true, even as someone who's mid-career, did not train in an era where we were routinely looking at a lot of prostatic MRs. We were doing them, but like we weren't fusing them. We weren't, you know, utilizing them in a way where I was needing to identify, oh, there's a nodule. It's kind of like, okay, there are nodules, but uniquely identifying that. So yeah, I think whatever cool technique, post-processing, you can develop, would be very useful. Is there something, you know, as you've been really digging into these MRIs, again, kind of for those of us that are more general, kind of providers, and, you know, what we may get a lung walk through the door and then a prostate, are there sequences that you say like, hey, these are really the key sequences, and until I get you that, until your project goes all the way forward and we get a heat map, what are the sequences that, you know, really you find kind of, these are the key ones that identify lesions?
Great question. So you're really going to be wanting to use the T2 weighted imaging, where you're usually going to see the lesion looking more kind of dark. On the area, you're going to want the ADC map, which is going to look a little bit like snow. but ideally, if you got a really conspicuous tumor, you're also going to see a nice dark lesion there. And then the diffusion weighted imaging, kind of like a higher B value, like around 2000 or so, you should also be, in this case, the tumor should be more bright white, ideally. So some combination of those three, and that should be part of the standard, you know, prostate MRI protocol from wherever you're located.
And I think that's helpful too, because as you get more rolling into the community, you get both community radiation oncologists, but then you get also community radiologists who may be reading more than just those prostate MRs. So I think it's also important to know and be aware of like, hey, what are the key sequences that I'm looking for, or maybe even asking for. And did you find anything that kind of made a difference in terms of kind of MRI quality or slice thickness that, you know, was harder to do any of these measurements or identification?
Like harder for the participants?
That's right. Yeah.
Or just in general. Yeah. So I'd say on not just looking at our participants, but also just based on our experiences looking at thousands and thousands of prostate MRIs here in our lab. Definitely slice thickness can kind of have a little bit of an effect, but it's really mostly, of course, hip implants, metal artifact. The classic prostate cancer patient has bilateral hip implants. I'm not sure why, but they do. And so that, of course, causes issues. We also found that being on any sort of anti-hormonal therapy, so of course ADT for prostates, but also even sometimes if they've been on anything for BPH, it definitely affects some of the signal. The conspicuity of the lesion significantly reduces. I mean, the prostate tissue, I think a lot of it's because the prostate tissue itself has involuted so much and changed so much. So that's actually one of the kind of next steps that our lab's really working on, is trying to adapt our RSI algorithm to better capture, you know, post-hormonal therapy tumors. Since now we're having more and more patients who are getting, you know, ADT prior to coming for a radiotherapy, and we'd like to still boost them if we can. But that's a very it's a specific, unique challenge for the imaging that we're excited to try and untangle with a separate prospective study that our lab is doing.
Great. Well, kind of on that note, that was going to be my next question of kind of the follow-up to this particular study, and then kind of some next steps. So why don't you just expand on that a little bit more?
Sure. So really the main follow-up for the study was that we were fortunate to be able to, we just published in the Red Journal at the end of August, the complete study. So what we really were able to add since spring time was really pathological sort of confirmation of all of the lesions. We were able to then go back to the, you know, original either systematic biopsy and or prostatectomy for 13 of the cases, and really, you know, give additional confirmation that this is the sextant, at least of the prostate, that the lesion was in, just to really, because before we had our participants were, we were comparing their contours to an expert contour that was generated by two radiologists. And then we wanted to just kind of confirm that, you know, it's not just the visible prostate on MRI based on what the experts think, but that this is truly where the tumor was. You know, we've done a lot of pathological confirmation in for our RSI algorithms. We wanted to make sure for these specific cases that everything, you know, lined up as we expected. So that was very good to see. And then we also really delved more into more information about the cases and lesions where there were complete misses. You know, when we add without the RSI maps and when we're contouring just on the regular MRI, 91% of our participants, regardless of their experience level, we had 50% were in residency, 50% were out of training. Most have used MRI at some point to treat prostate patients and met, and, you know, at least a third have been boosting patients. And so kind of a really good, I think, cohort, representative cohort of participants, and 91% missed at least once completely in our study. So we that was very interesting to us to really look at the numbers more in that perspective. And so I think that, and then when we added that that RSI map, you know, it brings the number of misses down dramatically from like 134 down to only 18 total out of 1600 total volumes that our participants drew. And so I think the first thing that we really pulled out now that we hadn't really looked at much in ACRO was just that this contouring on multiparametric MRI is really challenging and really trying to capture, you know, the wide variation and kind of the difficulty that radiation oncologists are having. And so I think it really also just underscores that we need more training in this area, or we need some sort of strategy to, if we're going to be starting to add this to our standard of care, you know, for patients going forward. So we're excited to potentially, we're starting to work with the eContour team, you know, which was also founded here at UCSD. They've got a new generation of eContour coming out soon. That's going to be iContour, which has a little more interactive component to it. And we're working with them to develop an educational module that, you know, will then be available online, you know, for free to all radiation oncologists, you know, around the world to kind of help with practicing that DIL contouring and giving actual feedback directly, you know, to your contours. And let's see, then the other really big exciting thing that's not in this current publication, but that we're working on developing now, is we're actually building radiation treatment plans off of each of these volumes for these to see, you know, so yes, we've, you know, dramatically improved accuracy in all of our metrics by at least 50%, but what does that mean for patients? Would what we're speculating is that it's going to hopefully result in higher dose to that tumor with without any higher dose of the OAR. So basically, can we get, because the FLAME trial and all these protocols really prioritize the OAR constraint over the dose that you're trying to get to the DIL correctly. So I've tried to do this safely. And so we're really thinking, and it's our results, preliminary results are suggesting that that is the case, that this decrease in variation actually would result in better treatment for the patients and not just, you know, mathematical or statistical improvement.
No, I find that very fascinating, and as you're describing that in the misses, it just speaks to some of our early literature where we were trying to do maybe focal treatments only and not any dose. You know, it wasn't a simultaneous integrated boosting, but and potentially maybe the problem was we just weren't treating everything or mm-hmm. not identifying everything. And that, you know, as our imaging improves, perhaps that's your, you know, next phase three. mm-hmm. Well, wonderful. Well, so happy to have you guys both join us in excellent abstracts. Final question, of course, is like, as you have done this research and, you know, kind of were able to kind of push it through to manuscript phase, anything you would have done differently, any frustrations, you're like, man, I wish I had done this, you know, 2 years ago kind of thing.
Yes. There were, you know, a few things that came up over the years. Really the first thing that we were able to then kind of we had to go back and correct it, but it cost us about 6 months of redoing some work was, you know, I'd really gone out of my way to make sure that we were collecting all of our volumes in a very blinded way. So I was very intentionally trying to make it so that on the back end, I could not easily, track back a certain volume or contour to a specific participant. And, you know, just for privacy and that kind of thing. But what we found was that we really wanted to be able to correlate the actual volumes then back to the, you know, the participant's experience level and, you know, and that kind of thing, just to see if any of those, other, you know, effects, fixed effects of the participants other than just the RSI map being there or not affected their results. So we ended up having to go back and connect everything, relabel all of our contours. So yeah, it took my team a lot of time. And so I regretted that a little bit, but we that really allowed us to do some much more sophisticated statistical analysis downstream with linear mixed effects models and really show that, you know, this RSI map supersedes the experience level or any of that, you know, for the participants. So I could have saved us some time if I had, you know, tried to keep track of all that. And then the last thing was, as we're building these radiation the actual treatment plans for these patients, when I was originally selecting these cases, I was selecting them for, you know, their imaging features and like actual how their MRIs looked and if they were, you know, representative of the class, you know, average patient and all those things. I did not at that time really think about the fact that I might want to build radiation treatment plans. And so I didn't also make sure that I was pulling cases for patients that had a CT sim already in ARIA. And so that's really limited how many of the patient cases we can build the radiation treatment plans on. You know, looking back, I would have even tried to, you know, be even more selective with which patient cases I included in the study, just to, you know, be able to do even more of this exciting stuff down the line.
Yeah, I can imagine, you know, kind of that discussion of how many things can you, it's like you, that balance of you don't want to collect too many for the patient privacy bit, but you're like, oh, but I might come up with a new question later. And so trying to collect as much up front and putting that all in that IRB so it's all covered for later.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you guys so much, Claire and Asona. It was awesome to chat with you. And a little plug to all of our listeners that the ACRO 2024 meeting abstracts are coming due here in November, and a plug for coming and our top abstracts. We plan to continue to kind of try to highlight people's excellent work and also just the experience of doing the research projects, because that information being shared and passed along is always the foundational building blocks for the next residents coming in as Asona and Claire, you guys transition from the PGY resident workhorses to the attendings doing the mentorship. I'm sure you'll share that knowledge with the future generations as well. And we're very thankful to our ACRO team that kind of helps to coordinate our webinar series, and be on the lookout for additional educational materials.